We present Beachcomber by the Way, selections from the humour of J.B. Morton, with Richard Ingrams as the author.
Hello, morons.
Interruptions by John Wells as Prodnose.
Well, takes one to know one.
You bastard.
With the considerable talents of Miss June Whitfield, Mr. John Sessions, Miss Joan Sims, Miss Patricia Routledge, Mr. Simon Greenall, Mr. Brian Bowles, and Miss Henrietta Garden. Beachcomber by the Way.
Greetings to my public. A friend of mine, thereby ruling out Prodnose, doubts whether men about town ever drank champagne from a lady's slipper. I cannot honestly say that I've ever seen it done, and when I was a youngster I was always too restrained in the presence of actresses to suggest such a manoeuvre. Imagine the preliminaries.
I'm having a simply divine evening, Marmaduke, darling. Simply divine.
Good, good. Can I have your shoe, my dear?
My what?
Your shoe.
My shoe?
Yes, I want to drink from it.
Really? Mm. Oh, well, just a minute. Here, hold my bag. This won't be easy.
Be careful.
Move the table back a bit, will you?
Hurry up, they're all looking.
Well, it's all very well you're saying hurry up. It's not easy to bend in this dress. Help me with this shoe buckle.
Yes, yes, come on.
Well, I don't know why you can't drink out of a glass like anyone else.
Ah, at last.
Happy?
Now hold it steady while I pour. Steady now. Oh, there's a corn plaster come floating up. Yuck. Oh, well. Slip it back on, my dear. Maybe next time.
Of course, nowadays, the surprise is not that anyone would wish to drink from a lady's slipper, but that anyone still wishes to drink at all, given the propaganda peddled daily by prigs against the honest consumption of alcohol. How about this for an up-to-date drinking song?
The horrid men who live on beer and swear in public bars have no digestion left except for fourpenny cigars. They stumble home at break of day and often end their lives beneath a lorry or a bus, unmindful of their wives. The millionaire who sips his port gets gout in all his toes, and children pass remarks about the colour of his nose. A sailor with his breezy air is sodden through with rum, and always meets a sordid death in some revolting slum. The whiskey drinker rots his brain and rots his liver too, and ends by making faces like the creatures at the zoo. I like my little glass of milk before I go to bed, for then I know that I shall wake without a splitting head. Thank you.
And now more news of Mrs. Wretch, the sequined sawdust sweetheart of Wugwell's Circus until her early retirement upon marriage nigh on 20 years ago to the eminently respectable Colonel Wretch. This intriguing announcement appeared recently in the national press.
The engagement is announced between Richard Liggington Rottenham, youngest son of Mr. and Mrs. E.L. Rottenham of Gurglebury Manor, Stitchhampton, and June Wretch, only daughter of Colonel and Mrs. Wretch of Wretch Manor, King's Knucklefeather.
I wish the young couple every happiness, although the announcement of their engagement has already had one unpleasant effect. Many of Mrs. Wretch's old circus colleagues have been calling in at Wretch Manor to convey their best wishes, much to the chagrin of the Colonel and the embarrassment of his wife. However, June has always got on remarkably well with her mother's old associates, to the secret pleasure of the Chatelaine of Wretch Manor, who perhaps misses the trampoline and tightrope more than she dare admit. It was doubly unfortunate that the visit of June's fiancé, Mr. Richard Rottenham, should have coincided with the unwelcome visit of the three Zigamaloos, who juggled with plates and dishes in the drawing-room in spite of all opposition.
Just ignore them, Rottenham. It's the only way. Look out for that soup plate, old chap.
I'm not used to this sort of thing, Colonel.
I am, I'm sorry to say.
But why don't you stop them?
They'd simply be followed by some other tomfool act from my wife's regrettable past. Mind that serving dish, Rottenham.
This is frightful, Colonel. I shall countenance no such antics in my home when June and I am married.
Really? How's your home a guest room, Rottenham? Oh, there you are, my dear. Rottenham, this is my wife, Utter.
Mr. Rottenham.
Charmed to meet you, Mrs. Wretch.
Look out, the side plates.
I've got them, boys.
Well caught, Mrs. Wretch. Not one saucer drop.
Indeed, none of your youngling skills have you lost. Oh, no.
Well, thank you, Charlie.
Get out. Get out at once, you crockery hurling hooligans.
Arthur.
We go as bidden, dear lady. Remember, there is still a pair of stilts with your name on them at Vugwell's. Farewell, Bimbo. Fare thee.
My dear, you must not encourage circus people in front of our future son-in-law. It is not seemly.
Oh, that's all right.
No, it is not. Nor do I wish my daughter to come into contact with these outlaws from decency. Why, only yesterday I found her practicing a rope trick which she said had been shown to her by one Anselmo Amentinelli, known at Wugwell's as the Whirling Midget.
His real name is Basil Partridge, dear.
I do not care. These shenanigans must stop.
Yes, Arthur.
Good. Now, where is the girl? Not with some knife-thrower, acrobat, or lion-taming rogue, we hope. Eh, Rottenham?
I do believe she's in the hall with the ringmaster.
What the...
Try not to get annoyed, Arthur.
What?
No, mate, it's your old pal Wugwell here, and with me, the artist hope for the art of circusry, Colonel, since your missus first shot the pipe out of the seal's mouth while balancing blindfold on the back of Edgar the Educated Zebra. A big hand, please, for Miss Juno Richard.
Hello, everyone. Awfully clever, eh?
June, cease that filthy handstand at once.
Go on, missy. Do the back somersault I taught you not 5 minutes ago.
Here goes. Ta-ra!
Disgusting.
June, there will be no need for you to go on like this when we are wed. I suggest you drop it.
Oh, poo. We're not living in the Middle Ages, Richard.
No, but we are living in Surrey.
If the circus was good enough for Mummy, it's good enough for me. And you can forget about our beastly engagement. Goodbye.
Now see what you've done, Wugwell. Get after her, Rottenham. Remind her about the wedding presents or something.
Oh, yes, righto.
Now then, my dear, what have you got to say about that, eh?
Well, it was quite a neat backflip, but she needs to work on her landing.
Yes, yes, now you mention it, old girl, I do believe you're right. I mean, the costume shows off her lovely body to great
somersaults and backflips.
Poor Rottenham, frustrated in his feelings for June by her tawdry fascination with the circus. The Colonel well understood his anguish. Mrs. Wretch, however, did not know whether to feel pride or annoyance, particularly as the next few days brought increasing numbers of visitors from Wugwell's. There was Tufty the Clown, whose social graces were confined to the squirting of soda water at unexpected moments and the making of terrifying grimaces. There were the Rubellinis, who tied themselves in knots to slow music. And there was a handsome young acrobat and contortionist named Harold Larkspur. He offered to walk round the room on his hands in memory of past times, but Mrs. Wretch, feeling suddenly old, courteously declined the offer. So Larkspur instead offered to teach June how to balance on one finger, an offer which was gaily accepted by the girl, resented fiercely by her father, criticised by her mother, and deplored sulkily by her former fiancé. After Larkspur had departed to prepare for that night's performance, Rottenham confronted the star-struck girl in the drawing-room of the manor.
June, if you really love me, you would cease these low antics forthwith. Circus skills have no place in county life, except possibly in Lancashire, or so I've sadly heard it rumoured.
Oh, Richard, must you be such a snob? I like the company of Mummy's old friends. They're fun.
But they bear tattoos and breathe fire and throw knives.
Rather than bread rolls, eh?
Exactly. I mean... Well,
at least all these people can do something. You can do nothing but moon about the place disapproving.
And at that instant, a horse trotted into the drawing room and placed its forelegs on the top of a round table.
You can't even do that.
I don't particularly want to.
Quite. And that's what's wrong with you. No ambition. Now, I must go and practice my plate spinning. Excuse me.
Don't bother. And you can shut up too.
With her marriage to young Rottenham seeming less and less likely as each day passed by, June began to encourage the attentions of the acrobat, Harold Larkspur. Unlike Rottenham, he had many accomplishments. By tapping his cheek, he could imitate the sound of beer being poured out of a bottle. He could tie himself in knots around furniture and put both feet behind his neck. And he could lift June up onto his shoulder using just one hand. There it was that her mother found her, and could not resist Larkspur's request that she should be lifted onto the other shoulder. The Colonel, coming upon the distressing sight, was informed that he was just in time to complete the pyramid by standing on Larkspur's head.
Get down from that strong man at once!
Oh, don't be a spoil sport, Daddy! Climb up and you can be on the top of our human pyramid!
I shall do nothing of the sort. Such behavior can barely be called human. And the pyramid is an exotic design which personally disgusts me. Rottenham and I are going out riding. And I assure you it shall not be bareback. Good day.
A further complication for June Wretch, and an added annoyance for both Richard Rottenham and the Colonel, was the arrival from Wagwell's circus of the Chinese conjurer So Ho Sho, who in private life is Mr. Fred Nurgle. He too was entranced by June's beauty, and he too began to compete for her affections. Having invited himself to afternoon tea at the manor, Fred, who was sitting next to the vicar's wife, suddenly produced from his mouth a string of small flags, accompanying each with a few hummed bars of the country's national anthem.
Mr. Nurgle, stop that at once.
The vicar's wife had fainted, but June was impressed, and Fred's offer to redeem himself with a display of fire-eating served merely to enchant her more. Torn between Larkspur, Soho Show, and the dull but dependable Rottenham, the confused girl turned to her mother for advice.
Oh, what am I to do, Mummy? Who should I choose?
Well, you must do as your heart dictates, my dear. Your father may not approve of my circus past, but he married me because he loved me. And I love him.
So I should marry Richard. But he's never produced a sixpence from my ear like Fred has. He's never bent the poker into a heart shape using his teeth like Larkspur did. Or kept a plate, a billiards cue, a hat and a chair in the air while smoking a cigar.
Yes, and one of your father's cigars, I recall. Such tricks would soon pall after the honeymoon, my sweet.
Oh, but Mummy, you still miss the old days. I know you do.
Well, I do sometimes find myself wishing your father would lie down on his back and let me stand on the soles of his feet. But it passes, my dear, it passes.
The next day, the confused young girl remained confined to her room and refused both food and visitors. And the next day, and the next. The Colonel and Mrs. Wretch began to worry desperately about her, and were on the verge of sending to King's Knuckle further for the doctor, when a letter arrived, addressed to June, in an envelope bearing an advertisement for Wagwell's Circus.
Hand me that paper knife, my dear.
But you can't open that, Arthur. Mm? It's not addressed to you.
Oh, can't I? It says, Dear June, this is being writ by Madame Zabula, every palm an open book, because me and Fred don't spell too good. Anyways, just to let you know, Wagwell has got us 3 months up and down the East Anglian Riviera, and we will not be coming round to teach you no more, nor beg for no kisses, says Fred. Our best you all, even your crusty old pa, yours, Harold Larkspur and Fred Nurgle, brackets, Soho Show, close brackets. Well, that's good news, isn't it, Utter?
I suppose so, dear.
What?
Poor June.
She'll have to marry Rottenham now.
It isn't as simple as that, Arthur.
Come again?
Indeed, it was not, for unbeknownst to them all, Rottenham was about to announce his engagement to another. It transpired that he had earlier gone to Wagwell's in an attempt to persuade the circus folk to stop calling at Wretch Manor, and in a side tent had met and fallen instantly in love with Madama Zozobova, real name Miss Sophie Nuttins, a bearded lady of some 23 summers. Tired of hiding her pretty dimpled chin behind a fringe of rough horsehair, she at once agreed to swap a life of unpredictable adventure for one of comfortable routine, and packing her few possessions in a small scarf, ran away from the circus with Rottenham. June Wretch cried when she heard the news, but not for long, as deep down she knew that marriage to either one of her three admirers probably would not have worked. Realising that she still hankered vaguely for the swoosh of the soda siphon, the garish make-up, and the antics of barely tame beasts, her parents paid for June to spend a year away in London society. Before she left, however, June made sure she wrote a letter to Wagwell, giving Richard Rottenham's address and inviting the circus to call in on their old friend and his new wife any time they were passing.
Aha! A writer hard at work. That's what I like to see.
Aha! Your bovine physiognomy. That's exactly what I dote.
Hmm. I know when I'm not wanted.
Really? Well, in that case, I apologise.
Apologise?
Yes, I've been telling everyone that you knew nothing whatsoever.
Pah!
I shall make up for this gross calumny by reading you the very latest entries from my dictionary for today.
Oh, dear, must you? Just an apology would do.
Silence, oaf! Today, the letter S for sacred. Adjective used to emphasise the duty of voting during a parliamentary election.
Bilge.
Scientific fact. Any hypothesis of popular science. Security. Shares in something that will go bust sooner or later.
Oh, bank 'em.
Self-determination. The right of any people to govern themselves, except those out of whom we hope to make money or those of whom we are afraid.
Bosh!
Self-expression. Doing whatever you please. She. A personal pronoun used in speaking of a motor car.
Oh, blather.
Shop assistant. A paid observer.
Claptrap.
And lastly, social duties. The struggle to get so-called celebrities to attend a dinner or cocktail party. There, that's enough for now.
Too much, I tell you. You go too far, you really do.
What an odd assertion to make, Prognose, when it is always you who does the travelling.
What? Oh, no, you mean...
Quite. Have a pleasant flight, Bole Weevil. Ah! More from the letter S and less one hopes from Prognose next time. And now, more news of big white carstairs, that dimmest of lights in darkest Africa. Carstairs recently imported from England into Africa a bankrupt hunt. Horses, foxes, hounds, clothes, horns, kennels and all. He picked them up for a song while on leave. But at the first meet, outside his residence on the lower Zubula, the natives greeted the spectacle with uproarious laughter.
Stop here, the funny. Stop there, two men. Don't you realise that to laugh at the pink is to laugh at all that England holds dear?
Pink, Buona Castes.
Well, it is where the mob hasn't got to. You see how between the serious stands. Now, look, will you all please be quiet?
Oh, very funny. Very funny.
This is ridiculous. What are you laughing at?
It's a funny play, no Buona Castes. You give pantomime, yes? Funny,
what?
Funny.
No, no, this is not a pantomime.
Oh, but these are pantomime horses, no? Very funny. Yes, very funny.
They are not that. They are real horses. Any fool can see that. They're just a bit tired from the voyage, that's all. Getting over seasickness. That's why they keep staggering about, I think. They'll soon pick up as soon as they hear the urgent call of the horn. Listen. Yeah, I was distinctly a fraud. It still works.
A bit hunting drum for you, Bonacaster.
No, 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 that's not the right thing at all. Now, where's that fox? I sent a fellow to get it ages ago.
Ah, Bonacaster, we no go near fox.
No,
we afraid, very afraid. The creature so small. So many men and dogs to catch it. It must be very fierce. Very fierce fox. Oh, yes, sir. No, no, no.
No, 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 not really. I think you're missing the point of this, you know.
Ah, then it's a very tasty, yum, yum, this fox. Very tasty, good to eat.
No, 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 it's inedible, I should think.
Then, why hunt this fox?
Look, I am getting sick of these questions. A gentleman hunts because it's a tradition.
Yes.
Maybe if Africa had a few less foxes, it would be a better place. Now, can
we... No, but there are no foxes in Africa.
What do you say?
Yes, Vanna, no foxes in Africa. No.
Well, there are now. Now, come on, release Renard. Yoicks, kill him! Hip, hip, kill him!
And off they went. At Carstairs' first cry of Tantivy, however, the natives grasped their spears and revolted in massed formation, thinking that the word was Tantivy, the name of a powerful head-hunting chieftain. The noise frightened the hounds, which ran off in search of food. Finally, the fox, maddened by heat and thirst, went for the weary horses, and order was only restored when Carstairs, his faded pink coat hanging in tatters, read a long speech in which he said that, owing to the prophecy of a witch-doctor, there would be no more hunting that season. This news was warmly received by all, except for a party of frustrated hunt saboteurs, who after great effort and expense arrived the next day on the boat from Southampton. And, as Carstairs said later...
I think in future I shall concentrate on more peaceful pastimes, like pig sticking.
And now for some more answers to correspondence, again with Mrs. Agatha Welkstaffer.
Hello, everybody. Agatha Welkstaffer with you once more, offering sound advice to the lovelorn and the confused. If that's you, then listen out. Here we go. Cyril, The initial error you made when the bottle of stout fell out of your pocket was to pretend it was champagne. Strong drink is strong drink, however gilded the atmosphere. Babs, the fact that he hugged your sister immediately after hugging you, crying, "Let 'em all come," may have been due to nervousness rather than to any partiality to your sister. Captain G, there is no harm in a false nose, qua false nose, at this season of the year, but perhaps you should have got to know the family better before playing tricks. Millie, if you suspect him of not being a big game hunter, challenge him to take you to his lodgings and show you some of the camel's heads of which he is always boasting. Fred, I don't think you should take too seriously her claim that her mother is a dowager. The fact that three of the family pearls smashed when you flipped them is a bad sign. Amelia, you say, dear, that his old Etonian tie and guard's braces led you to assume that he was a gentleman, but surely suspicion must have reared its hideous head when he playfully twanged the elastic of his made-up bow tie in front of your mother. And finally, for now, Bob. Bad luck, Bob. How could you have guessed that the man on the pier who photographed you in polo kit on a wooden pony would turn out to be her brother? Anyhow, if she only loved you for your polo, she lacks stability and would be no wife for an insurance agent.
But then does any woman deserve such a fate? Our thanks to Mrs. Wilkstaffer for not taking too much of our time. And now to matters ornithological. Do you know a puffin from a blow-in?
No.
Do you know how Gillette discovered the razorbill?
No.
Do you even know that great orcs from little orchorns grow?
No.
Then pay close attention now, ignoramus.
Greetings, listeners. Your countryside chum, Arthur Stoutbread, speaking, as we find ourselves once again alone with nature in this beautiful Sussex wood. A sylvan cascade of melody rings through the copse, telling us that the shy gooseneck is about to feed her young ones on some succulent water vimp. She has made her nest of straw and grasses high in the moss-grown fork of a hornbeam, and lower down the trunk a ptarmigan is boring a hole in which to store worm casts and acorn stalks against the rigours of next winter. But hark, the tiny beercrest is calling from a neighbouring clump of alder. Well, I'm sure she'll call in just a moment. Thank you. And a rufous widgeon, or clinker, wings its way peacefully above the trees to the reedy pool. And there, from a tulse-fringed grot among the tansy, a weed warbler pops out his tousled head to snap at a bobfly for his breakfast. The weed warbler is larger than the chipchuff, and more often than not makes his nest high in the tall snodgrass, way above the beautiful floral carpet formed by the luxuriant tinker's foot, the dwarf umbrella, shark's fin bugloss, sweet chumbrill, duck spur, steamweed, St. Anselm's wort, and mopsy under the river. But sadly, I must go now, listeners, or I will miss my train. Goodbye all, until next time.
Mervyn, I don't know what you thought you were playing at in that cubicle of yours.
Arthur, we're under an enormous amount of...
Well, that may be, but it's my reputation here on the line in front of the listeners, Mervyn. No, Mervyn, I've never said this before, but I've got nothing personally against your type of person in general, so don't take this personally.
A cow that gave, and I quote, 1,980 gallons of milk in 12 hours, is possibly the victim of a misprint. Or is a cow with a conscience overcompensating for the failings of its sisters? When I was head cowman at Bolton Windfevers in the time of old Lord Shortcake, we had a cow called Damson, which never gave any milk at all. She lived to be 32 and gradually became part of the household. She would lie by the fire in the library until I came to take her to her stall, and was finally shot by an old sportsman in the middle of the night. He had dreamed of tigers, and ran out in his pyjamas and shot Damson dead. This song may, I believe, have been written in her honour, but as more or less everyone was pretty sick of her by then, I doubt it.
Lovely big cow at the edge of the wood, I will give you an apple if you are good. I want to be kind before the chance goes, for Aunt Sarah told me, and she always knows. That somebody told her, I hope he was wrong, would be put in a bottle before very long. So lovely big cow, whose hide is all mottled, eat up your apple before you are bottled.
I read in my newspaper that, and I quote, the old cursing and swearing sailor with a wife in every port is a thing of the past. How true. It is indeed very different today. I overheard this conversation only yesterday on the deck of a battleship.
Have you noticed, Abel Seaman Jackson, how exquisitely the sun gilds the edges of the little clouds?
Aye.
And the seagulls cut and glide through the salty air. But hey-ho, I suppose we must not neglect our swabbing of the decks.
Oh, gee, no naval rating codgers. Elsewhere, our excellent commands are fine fault with us. A contingency which the imagination can hardly suppose.
You're right.
Swab away, my friend. Ha! How sweet and satisfying is life on the ocean wave, as the song has it.
Indeed, yes. Yet would I fain be at home with the wife of my bosom.
Ah.
The beloved Agnes.
Aye. And I with her whom I hope one day to make Mrs. Jackson. She awaits me in Singapore. Ah, Rose of the audience, I come.
Singapore? Oh, my friend. Can such a place be fitted for a pure young girl?
For far the virgin innocence of her lustrous eyes, old man, the devilish hordes of tempters wince and withdraw. No harm can come to my popsy-wopsy.
Oh, that's all right.
Attention, Seaman Jackson. Attention, Seaman Jackson.
Hey, that's you, Yusuf Get.
Please go at once to the chaplain's office, where you will learn in confidence that your girlfriend has been arrested for running a house of ill fame.
Oh, hey, hey.
And writing codgers, the seagulls have found the poop deck again. Thank you.
Oh, what again?
Oh, that...
The lying...
Bastards.
Bitch. The little...
Would you believe it?
Despite what you've heard, life aboard ship is not a hoot. Goodbye, pond life.
That was Beachcomber by the Way, adapted for radio by Michael Barfield, with Richard Ingrams, who appeared as Beachcomber. John Wells, June Whitfield, John Sessions, Joan Sims, Patricia Routledge, Simon Greenall, Brian Bowles, and Henrietta Garden played the other characters. Your announcer was Perkins, and the producer was Thompson. And we have just received news while that programme was on air that Dr. Strabismus, whom God preserve of Utrecht, has invented a small circular spoon with a hole in the middle, through which the cook can look at whatever he or she is about to stir. According to early reports just coming in, the spoon has no handle, so that when looking through the hole at, say, porridge, the cook must hold the spoon by the rim of the bowl. To facilitate stirring, a handle can then be fitted to the strabismus spoon, or else an ordinary spoon can be used instead. We hope to be able to bring you more details in our next full news bulletin. BBC Beachcomber News.